From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Talk that matters. Germ Warfare and Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Germ Warfare at tntradio.live. It's my email address. Send me an email. As always, let me know where in the world you are. I am back in my studio. I was in the mountains the last couple of days. I'm sure you would have heard. There was a somewhat suspicious internet connection that I was using, but it was absolutely worth it in the end. Had amazing conversations and got through it. As I said, I'm back. It is always nice to be home, although the weather is still terrible. Apparently, this is the worst rain that Cape Town has had in, what, almost a decade. There's been flooding all over the place. Mountain passes have been shut down and closed. And it's not raining at the moment while I'm speaking to you, but it just hasn't stopped for, I think, about 10 days now. The trend has just been exceptionally wet, which is great. I mean, the farmers love it, but it does cause a bit of havoc. We've had a few leaks in the house because it's the constant downpour. Eventually, you know, it finds the weak points in the house. But nevertheless, getting through it bit by bit. Jump into the live chat on TNT's website. I've got it open in front of me. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
There's a lot going on, so it's important to stay informed and up to date.
Get ready, because here we go.
At the top, 30 minutes past and when it breaks.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I'm not going to reveal your identity, but I'm just going to refer to you as Scott in China. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
That's good. Thanks for having me. It's an opportunity to share notes.
I love sharing notes. That's what this show is all about. It's about countering narratives, busting myths. It's about trying to figure out how the puzzle fits together.
Well, that's what we're going to try and do.
Okay, so obviously you're in China. I don't want to interrogate too much, but why are you there?
Well, I can do a little bit of an introduction. I guess after a couple of decades, I qualify as an old China hand. I can still remember what it was like when China was the third world. So those times are past. Of course, I wasn't always in China. I grew up partly in the U.S., as you can hear, partly in Europe. Went to school, went to university in Europe, mostly in Germany and Switzerland. But also in that same period, the university period, I also spent some time in Asia, in Japan and China. Then after university, I went to work for a German multinational, which eventually then sent me back to China. So that was kind of how I landed here. I kind of learned from them what I was able to learn, did the big business thing. And then after a couple of years, I decided it was enough. And then I went independent and built up a couple of businesses, or I guess I should say helped build them up. There were a lot of other people involved as well. And one of those businesses right now is actually in the media sector. We focus on business world related content, and mostly in Chinese. But we do also publish something occasionally, some stuff in English on Substack, and that's how we kind of connected. So that's the background.
Your Substack is fascinating, which is obviously why I invited you. Now, just to suppress some of those ridiculous fears that are going to be thrown my way, I'm not concealing your identity, Scott, because you're in China. We're not going to get into that. But the reasons why we're concealing your identity is not because we're scared of the Chinese government.
It's just always best reasons. To be. There's some advantages to retaining a bit of anonymity. Yeah.
Mm. Yes, and also the ideas here are more important anyway than who you are.
Right. Well, it's not a big secret, but just don't want to advertise it too much. Mm.
For sure. Okay. So your Substack is very much in line with where I'm at the moment, trying to bust myths about China.
Well, we appreciate that. Quickly, it's very rare.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, this COVID narrative has... It's it's opened my eyes to a lot of what's going on in the world, and I think many other eyes. And if I'm to be consistent about challenging certain narratives, then I need to be consistent in challenging certain narratives, right? So I've got to go across the board. And one of those is that I've grown up with the idea that China is this totalitarian communist hellhole. That's all I've been told my whole life.
You can tell how young you are, because it wasn't always that way.
I'm in my 40s.
Really? Was it that bad when you're 20 years ago?
No, well, that's the narrative. That's right. That's how it's, it is. I mean, I wouldn't know. And I mean, I'm a cartoonist of 20 years, and in my books, you will think that China is this totalitarian hellhole. Now, I won't draw those cartoons now. But the point is this. We need to bust a few myths, and that's why I'm chatting to you. And I want to start with the foundation of your Substack. What is Austrian economics?
Yeah, well, you asked me that in advance, and I thought about it, and it is kind of a tough question to answer succinctly. And, you know, we could talk about that for, you know, 2 hours. So I thought about it, and what I came up with was, I guess that the core message of Austrian economics is that big government and printing a lot of money is maybe not such a good idea. Now, of course, there's a lot more to Austrian economics than that, but that's, I guess you could say that that's kind of the core of it. You know, a lot of people when they hear Austrian economics, if they've heard of it at all, they sort of think of the term free market economics, and there's somebody that, but that's, you know, it's kind of a fuzzy term, and to pin yourself down that is doesn't really tell you that much. I think practically speaking, you can look at Austrian economics as a kind of a toolkit. It's a toolkit to understand what's going on. It's a toolkit to understand what the effects of government policies are. And it's a toolkit to understand why letting bureaucrats decide how to allocate resources tends to lead to bad results. And finally, I mean, if we talk about what's really current, and particularly in the last, you know, 10 years, it tells us a lot about why setting artificially low interest rates and printing all the associated money is a terrible idea. And why essentially this policy represents a massive subsidy to the well-connected parties in society. And, you know, there's a group of people out there that consider this part of the alternative media that say, well, you know, we should have government money and the government should set, you know, low interest is great. You know, there shouldn't be any interest. That's a popular theory out there. But from the Austrian perspective, interest is the price of money. And if money doesn't have a price, well, who's going to get it? It's not you and it's not me. It's the well-connected people. So money needs to have a price, and it should be a free market price. Unfortunately, in the world as we know it, it's not really that case anywhere. It's not a free, there's no free market for money almost anywhere. The interest rates are set all over the world by the central banks. And they use that for their own purposes and, of course, to manipulate their exchange rates as well. But at the end of the day, particularly in those countries that, in the West that have followed this zero interest rate policy for the last, well, up until last year, until for 12 years, basically, longer than that, the effects have been disastrous. We see the results everywhere. It's basically the rich, or at least part of the rich, have gotten much, much richer, and the rest of society has gotten much poorer. In China, we have kind of the same thing. I mean, it exists as well. The Chinese central bank definitely printed a lot of money as well. But it's not quite as bad because we never went to zero in China. I think the lowest we ever got was around 4%. But generally speaking, you had to pay 6. And that's for companies with very good credit ratings. So... yeah, that's the rough part. Of course, if we want to go a little bit farther back, Austrian school, you know, founded in the 19th century, as the name sort of connotes, connected with Vienna, University of Vienna. And you know, the Austrian school is has contributed a lot to even mainstream economics. For example, things like terms like marginal cost, marginal utility, those are accepted parts of mainstream economics, and those all come from the Austrian school. But you usually won't hear much about the Austrian school if you go to university in the West, and that's because it's not very much in favor amongst the people, let's say, the ruling classes, and for understandable reasons, because essentially, they like to spend money on things they see as useful, and they like to decide on how that money is spent. And the Austrian schools is basically, that's kind of theft, really. And so it's understandable they don't approve of that. Now, I went to university about a couple of hundred kilometers from Vienna, but I never in my entire university career heard the word Austrian school. And this is despite the fact that Austrian school is also all those contributions I mentioned, also Nobel Prize winners, extremely influential. I never even once heard the word. I also went to the top business school in Switzerland, never heard the word. I mean, it's really shocking, but that shows to you where the interests of the ruling class lie and why Austrian economics doesn't get very much promotion. You know, luckily for the world, it did get quite a bit of promotion through Ron Paul in 2008. That was kind of where a lot of people became aware of it, because he did a lot to promote that. And particularly, he emphasized his ties to the Mises Institute in the U.S. And that got a lot of people on board. I was on board a little bit before that, but that's kind of where a lot of people made that link. In China, the Austrian school is, I'd say it's also kind of a mixed bag. It was never suppressed the way it was in the West. I actually once saw Human Action, which is Mises' masterpiece, on sale at the airport in Chinese. You would never see that in the West. And pretty much all the entire corpus of Austrian literature has been published in China. Well, that's to all of the major works, you know. Murray Rothbard, all the stuff has been published in China, with one exception. There was one that was a little bit too hot even for China. But generally speaking, China is open to these ideas. But as China has become, let's say, less, as free speech has become less of a thing here in the last 5 years, certainly that's died down a bit. I wouldn't say it's really suppressed, but there's less talk about that than there was, say, 5 years, and certainly what there was 10 years ago.
That free speech thing is one of the hot potatoes whenever you talk about China, and the idea of trying to merge Austrian or free market economics with the concept of China, it gets everybody just into this weird state of confusion, because it doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, if you're coming with their assumptions, you can understand where they're coming from.
Well, I mean, while we're on that, is China a centrally managed economy?
I think the answer to that is it really depends which China we're talking about. Are we talking about today's China or the China 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago? 40 years ago, yes, definitely. I mean, China did the whole socialism thing, we tried it all out. And at the end, there was one Chinese intellectual that said, one of my favorite quotes, he said, "All the propaganda in the world can't convince a man he's not hungry." And as the Austrians would say, basically what China did is it used up all of its capital. And by 1976, it was gone. They were at rock bottom and they had to try something else. So they did. If you fast forward to 1995, at that point, the government spending was around 11% of GDP. Should tell you something. Much, much smaller than anywhere in the West. And the private sector gradually over time became larger and larger. One of the things you asked me earlier was whether something about, privatization. That was kind of a thing at the beginning. There was some privatization that went on, but not that much. Really what happened is just mostly the state-run companies shrank. and the private sector took over. And even today, despite the fact that things have gone downhill, I'll explain that a bit more what I mean by that. Things have gone downhill quite a bit in the last, let's say, 10 years. But the private sector has continued to grow. So the private sector now, according to most estimates, and I know we kind of disagreed there, you had some different sources. Most estimates are around 75% of the economy. But if you look at the numbers, you know, the numbers of companies, most of them are, you know, private sector by far. The state sector is infinitesimally small. And more importantly, all the jobs come from the private sector. The state sector is not hiring anybody on the net at all. And almost all the innovation comes from the private sector. 93% of patents applied for come from the private sector. However, going back to what I said earlier, things have gone downhill in the last 10 years, specifically, and this is once again from the Austrian perspective, because the state has done two things. One is they started to print a lot of money, which they weren't doing before 2008. They're printing about 11% a year, which is a little bit, which is similar to what was going on in the US and Europe until in the same period. The other thing they started doing is deficit spending, which they weren't doing before either. And they've blown up the government spending to now, the last I checked, it was about 35% of GDP, which is pretty bad. In the US, I think the US is about 43%. It's higher, but it's still pretty bad, 35%. So, you know, is it centralized? Yeah, I mean, the more the government is involved, the more you see the government as the buyer in the economy, well, the more distortions you're going to get, right? And the government's not a very efficient buyer in general. You know, the private sector looks very carefully at how they spend their money. And the public sector, well, you know, okay, maybe it's not as bad as in a place like, I don't know, Nigeria. It's certainly a lot better than that. The Chinese public sector does have methods, bureaucratic methods of, you know, combating corruption and controlling costs. But still, it's not, you know, it's not compatible. It's not comparable with the free what private sector businesses do. And at the end of the day, the government, you know, they can just print money if they need more of it. And that's the problem. However, that said, I kind of feel like we kind of hit rock bottom here in the COVID years. I mean, they really just went all out, you know, printed even more money, not as much as in the US, but they still printed a lot of money. And unlike in previous years where you could say, well, a lot of the things they use those money for, at least they were productive. You know, they build trains and highways and, well, okay, maybe it's not that, you know, maybe there's some waste going on, but at least it was, you know, useful. But what they did in the last 2 years was not very useful, to put it mildly. Mm. So they printed a huge amount of money, didn't do anything useful with it. And now I think it really can't get any worse. And I think the government realizes that they've got to change. They can't keep going down this route. And they have you can tell in a lot of sectors, the government has, the government regulatory impact has decreased. Has decreased substantially in the last 2 years. And that started even before the end of the COVID period. They stopped a lot of the stupid stuff they were doing back in the, you know, 2018, 2019, 2020, or 2019. A lot of silly regulations where they were basically enforcing things that just do absolutely no good for the economy at all. But they said, well, we have a rule and we have to enforce all the rules, right? But, you know, it was a stupid rule, right? And so it didn't make any sense to enforce. So a lot of those type of rules are just being ignored at the moment. You know, hard to say whether it'll last, but you can definitely tell that the wind has shifted in a big way. And that's because they're in deep trouble. They really dug themselves into a deep hole. Does that answer your question?
All right, Scott. Yes, it does. I'm just going to quickly go to a break. I'll be back with you shortly. My name is Jerm, chatting to Scott in China. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Dirk Pohlmann.
You are, of course, the left-winger. You were nowhere close National Socialist ideology, but you got an unfriendly letter from a German state prosecutor. And as a German, I'd like to excuse my country for this bullshit.
So, yes, I'm apparently being investigated for, I think the law states in the Gesetzbuch, for disseminating propaganda, the content of which is intended to further the aims limbs of a former national socialist organization, end quote. So obviously the direct opposite of my intention. So that's the story.
Probably because of the intention of this book, which has a lot of essays about how this strange government atmosphere that surrounded the COVID-19 disease resembles a totalitarian approach to society. And it's not really the totalitarian design that the communists or the Nazis had, but it is totalitarian. Totalitarian meaning that it tries to rule into every aspect of your life, and you have to comply. There's no possibility to dissent.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party? You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
The conversation continues.
When these parents come into that school board meeting in a huge group, they will back down.
On today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Scott, I think one of the things that always derails people is the fact that the word communist is in the CCP or whatever they call themselves. What's it, the Chinese Communist Party or the Communist Party of China? But the word communist CPC always gets people.
Right. Well, what can we say to that? Well, first of all, even the Chinese government doesn't refer to China as communist. It refers to China as socialist with Chinese characteristics. I believe that's the official line. And that was always the case in the previous Eastern European countries in the Soviet Union. There was never a claim that they were communist. This is a Western usage, right? It's not related to the actual usage in those countries that were ruled by quote unquote communist parties. According to the sort of Marxist vision, as I understand it, the communism is supposed to be the the final goal, the end state where, I think as Marx put it, you'll go fishing in the morning and hunting in the afternoon, and we'll all be living carefree lives. And I don't know, somebody's going to be cleaning the toilets, but we're not too sure who that is because, you know, he didn't talk about that. but yeah, the short answer is no. I think that's it's just a label, you know, it's a label of a party. You know, if somebody belongs to a party that calls itself the, you know, Democrat Party or the Democratic Party, does that mean that person is a Democrat, you know? Or somebody, you know, there are lots of people in the U.S. that call themselves conservatives. And I think a lot of us have big doubts about that, whether they really are conservatives. Well, in China, for historical reasons, they call themselves the Communist Party, right? Does that mean that China is communist? Well, the obvious answer is no. It is what it is. And those are often quite different from the labels that are attached to them. Is the U.S. A capitalist country? Well, I'd say there's some differing opinions about that. Is the U.S. a democratic country? I say there's all sorts of differing opinions about that. Some people think the U.S. is not very democratic at all. so there you go. Be careful, labels. That would be my answer.
The thing that makes me laugh also is how short-sighted people are. They go, oh, the word communist is in the party's name, so therefore it should be a clue. Okay, well, the word democratic is in Korea's name. It's, what is it? The People's Democratic Republic of Korea, or something like that, right? They're not democratic. Right. It doesn't matter what's in the name. It's what the reality is. It's what the reality is. And here's what got me thinking. So think about this for a second, right? How is it possible that if communism is, let's say, East Berlin, right? It's gray and it's poverty stricken. How do you get to where China is, almost the world's most powerful economy. You've got millions and millions and millions of Chinese people happily touring the world and going back home. Lots and lots of billionaires in China. How is it possible that this is complete communism? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obvious to you and me. That's obvious, but for some reason, some people get stuck on these labels, and they, I don't know. One interesting, you know, aspect of that whole conversation is that apparently all these people out there
that they're spies.
They perceive China as this great menace, right? They say, oh, this terrible, you know, Orwellian dystopia, whatever society, and they are going to take over the world, right? This Michael Singer book, where it says, "Yo, the Chinese are control all the governments all around the world," and you know they're, and people think that they're doing this because they're, you know, really successful communists. What does that mean? It actually implies these people really believe communism, as however they interpret it, must be some really great system, right? I mean, if it's really as powerful as they say, I mean, it must be a great system, right? So, I mean, obviously the Austrian take is that's, of course, bullshit. What communism does, or let's say socialism, maybe I shouldn't say that on air. Socialism, what socialism does is it uses up capital. It uses up capital until it's gone, right? And then at some point, then they have to start over, right? And start accumulating capital again. And that does not produce wealth, because capital is wealth. And when we talk about capital, usually we're not referring to money and a bunch of, you know, bills printed. We're talking about actual productive resources, right? And a society has to build up those resources. You know, it could be human resources, but also, you know, material resources and the know-how that's associated with using them. And then and that makes societies wealthy, right? And you can't do that just by printing money, or, you know, some people say paying subsidies or whatever people come up with. They say, oh, China's successful because they pay sub. They, what do they say? They dump products at under cost, and they subsidize the companies. But you can't get rich that way. That doesn't work. I mean, it's basic economics, and even the more mainstream economics will admit that doesn't work, right? So yeah. So how did we get here? Well, they got there first of all by hitting rock bottom in 1976. That was first thing. So they ran out of capital, and no one was out there to bail them out. And like in East Germany, and who bailed out East Germany? Well, West Germany bailed out East Germany for decades. They subsidized East Germany massively, and so East Germany managed to, you know, stumble on and provided its citizens with a relatively high level of living, standard of living for the Eastern Bloc. China didn't have West Germany to bail it out. It had to bail itself out. And it's a long story, but there were some deals done with the Western elite back in, you know, around 1980, 1979. They were also connected to the one-child policy, that's a whole other topic, where that one-child policy come from, not much appreciated in the West. But there were some deals made, and China needed capital desperately, and they got it partially from the West, but partially just by their own bootstraps, you know, working hard and saving. And China's had, you know, savings rates in the 30 to 40% range since then. And it mostly got there by leaving people alone, you know, basically by the government letting people get on with business, doing their own thing. Also by not asking too many questions. You know, you can walk into a bank in China with a couple million dollars in cash and no one will ask any questions, like, where is that money from? And even today, that's still true. Can't do that anywhere in the West. You walk in any bank in Switzerland with 1,000 francs and they'll ask you all sorts of questions. But here you can walk in with $1 million and no questions asked. Big difference. Another really good decision they made at that point was they decided not to tax small business on profits. And that's, I think it's relatively rare. You know, you have a lot of countries with large informal sectors, but China decided to integrate its informal sector into the economy. And it did that by only taxing small business on floor space and very minimal taxes. So if you're a restaurant or a small shop, you don't have to declare to the government how much money you made. You pay a minimal tax based on your floor space, and that's it. No accounting required. And that basically brought all that business into the formal economy. I think that was one of the best decisions they made. Basically leaving people alone. on the, you know, for, if you talk about larger companies, that obviously there's more interference that goes on there. But generally speaking, you know, the burden, the regulatory burden, the taxation burden is still much, much lower than in the West. That said, once again, here I have to say it's getting, it got a lot worse after the regime change in 2013. So in 2013, before 2013, we had a right-wing government. We had a right-wing government for over 20 years. And then in 2013, since then we've had a left-wing government. We're talking in Beijing, right? The central government. That said, another thing that's important to understand, and that's one thing that very few people outside China understand, is that China is very regionalized. So there are very distinct policies that are pursued by provinces and by individual cities. And they are quite different, and they tend to be relatively sustained as well. So, you know, to give one example, at Shanghai, where I am, it's Shanghai has had pretty much strongly, let's say, right-wing philosophy for the, you know, since I can remember, certainly for at least 20 or 30 years. And that's been reflected consistently in the style of governance. There was one year when the current big kahuna in Beijing took over in Shanghai, and we had a little bit of a left swing then. But it didn't last. You know, there have been occasional outliers there. But for the most part, Shanghai has been very consistent in its, let's say, pursuit of the night watchman approach to managing economies. One of the big outliers and big exceptions was, of course, during this COVID thing, back when we had the 2-month-long Shanghai lockdown. I don't know if you know that or not, but at the time, the Beijing government basically suspended the Shanghai government. They said, you guys are just not, you know, you're not following the program here. And they sent their deputy, Sun Chunlan, down to Shanghai to take over. And she basically, you know, sidelined the entire Shanghai government for 2 months and basically ignored the policies that we had in place. And after 2 months, she left. Her policies were a disaster. And now we're back to more sane policies. But so that's the other part of the answer is really it's very different on a regional basis. But generally speaking, so they learned a lot of lessons, made some really good decisions. And then they slipped into the trap that many countries have slipped into. They got rich and lazy and they thought, well, you know, we'll print a little bit of money and it was nice and convenient and, you know, we'll invest in things we think are important. And then, you know, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. And now we're at 35% of GDP, right? But okay, we did get a lot of nice trains and we did get a lot of nice roads. You know, they're nice roads all the way to the border of Pakistan, you know, and wonderful, you know, 5G internet everywhere. But, you know, at a price. And the price is, you know, the more the government spends, the deeper the hole is you dig yourself into. And now they're in a pretty deep hole. So we can only hope that they've seen the light. I think there is some substantial evidence for that, but only time will tell.
What's interesting, though, is everything you're saying applies to the USA or the UK, for example, or pretty much any other country. You know, if you spend too much money, you're going to end up in a problem. And if you print too much money, you're going to end up in a problem.
Yeah, the same laws of economics apply everywhere, you know.
It's so strange, though, Scott, that people just do not want to think critically about this. Why do you think that there's this mental block when we talk about China? It's this bizarre nut that seems impossible to crack for the most part. And I mean, you've seen it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know how to say it in polite company, I mean, there's a campaign going on to demonize China, you know? I mean, for some reason, many people in the West seem to be blind to it. But I mean, for those of us in China, of course, it's much easier because we, you know, particularly those who were here before, we saw what was before and what was after. And this campaign started in about 2008. There wasn't that big of a difference between China pre-2008 and post-2008. You know, there were some differences over time, but there was a really clear point in time when that China demonization campaign started in 2008. So I think that's the reason. You know, if I were an alien, you know, looking down from above, I would say, well, that looks a lot like war propaganda to me. I mean, those of us that are closer to the ground, that's maybe not so clear, but you know, if you look back to the run up to World War II and World War I, a lot of very similar phenomena going on. This is a little bit of a longer starting period, but you know, and if you look at any country, you can always find things to criticize. And certainly, you know, our position is that China is no shortage of things to criticize. But, you know, I always think it's funny because, you know, we're very critical of a lot of the decision, the policy decisions of the governments, or the governments, I mean, the national ones, the local ones. But the problems that we see are almost never mentioned in the West and the Western sources. And I think the reason for that is because a lot of the problems that we see are the same mistakes that the Western countries are making as well. So, of course, they don't want to criticize that, like printing all this money. Well, it's because they're doing the same thing, right? So printing, you know, criticizing China for that doesn't go anywhere. So they have to find other stuff, right? So they invent stuff like then there are real issues, you know, or they say stuff like, oh, China is killing all the pets or something like that, right? That's the sort of stuff they come with, right?
There was one dog
killed in Shanghai during the lockdown, right? And then now the story came out, oh, the China's killing all the house pets.
It's ridiculous.
And they say China, right? As if China is this monolithic entity, you know. People can't see, but I'm moving my hands around. It's like the Borg, you know. The Borg killed, you know, it's killing all the house pets, you know.
Scott, I'm quickly going to go to a break. I'll be back with you in a moment. My name's Germ, chatting to Scott in China. This is TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
So after a five-year investigation, Joe Biden's son Hunter got the sweetheart deal that many of us thought he would get. After pleading guilty to not paying his taxes for 2 years and for illegally owning a gun, Hunter will likely face no jail time. It's nice when your daddy is president. In fact, Joe Biden has repeatedly said his son did nothing wrong. Well, that's news to Hunter, who, as I said, pleaded guilty. And by the way, the Congress is still investigating him, along with his dad, for an alleged bribery scheme. How did the media react to the whole thing? Like it was one big Father's Day present for Joe.
And this president has also been very open about the very real struggle that his son has faced with addiction. Now he is very proud of his son for having gotten through that. To see that be something that has been tried to use to launch political attacks against him has been very difficult, I think, for this president personally. I think it has pained the president to see his son be used to launch political attacks against him for so many years now.
That's ABC's White House correspondent Mary Bruce, and it was the same happy daddy narrative throughout the phony media. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Scott, the other one that always comes up, social credits, mass surveillance. You are being hyper-controlled, Scott.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little hard to know where to start with that one, right? Because it's been that story has been repeated so often in Western, not only media, but in on social media mostly. And people have, so many people have this strange tendency to believe that if it's on social media, if it's on someone on YouTube, then it must be true, right? I mean, those are just, you know, casual YouTubers, you know, telling their private stories, right? So if it's there, it must be true, right? Well, no, I mean, YouTube is a business and people there, you know, make money off of it. And not everything on YouTube is true, as I guess probably most people know, but maybe they don't think about it. Well, the short of it is that system doesn't exist. It's just complete propaganda.
Oh, shots fired.
Yeah, there is something. Some people say, well, there is something called, you know, social credit. Yeah, because the government has some system where there's some plan where they assign some sort of ratings to companies. But in terms of individuals, no, there's just nothing like that out there. You know, one of the things that, I often mention when people, you know, say, oh, how can that be? I said, well, you know, think about it. What, you know, there are all these videos made, particularly in Europe. It's actually, it's even worse than in the US. In Europe, they have this French-German broadcaster called Arte, which makes, I think they made a big documentary about it. And it's just, it's, it is so dishonest. It's, I don't know, I'll just shake your head, but there's just very little counter narrative in Europe. Whereas at least in the US, you have a few people who say, no, there's a problem with this narrative. It's something that doesn't match up. In Europe, you don't get that at all. But the biggest issue, of course, is that, you know, if this system really exists, well, what's it look like? I mean, why don't we see some screenshots, you know, of something out there? And, you know, if it's really that terrible, if you know, everybody's really afraid to say anything, well, you know, then why do we have all these efforts to shut down, which exist, you know, to shut down people's voices in China? You know, there was one, when we were in that lockdown in Shanghai, there was one video that a guy in Shanghai did, which got 400 million views, right? And, you know, you'd think if he were, you know, if there was a system like this, he'd be afraid, right? Well, I mean, he was known who he was. The government eventually did manage to, quote unquote, shut it down after 400 million views. But by that time, I mean, it's kind of late, you know? So, yeah, I mean, there is, and this gets into the bigger topic of censorship, there is censorship in China, and it's gotten much, much worse in the last 10 years. And we sometimes jokingly refer to it as China's zero speech policy, which is, let's say, it's beyond absurd. People, all these topics are considered to be sensitive. You can't talk about them. But the context you have to put that in is that what can happen to you if you say something they don't like? Well, usually the worst thing that can happen to you is eventually your social media might be blocked for a week. That's usually the most could happen to you. And, you know, there are a few cases where people have gotten arrested. If you go out and march in the streets and say down with the government, well, then eventually they're going to arrest you. You might not stay in jail for very long, but eventually they'll probably arrest you. They don't like that. But there are very few people that have actually gone to jail for it. And if in the cases where they have, as far as I know, usually 3 to 5 years is like the maximum. And this is extremely rare because they just, you really have to work hard to irritate them to get to that point. But if you look at, if you come at a place like the US, for example, you know, there you're getting all these people condemned, you know, sentenced to 15 years, 10 years, 25 years for saying things the government doesn't like. Unheard of here. You just don't have that pressure here, which you would if there were that the system like that. So one other thing to say about the social credit storyline is that they, like all good, you know, propaganda narratives, it does have an element of truth to it, and they basically take pieces of truth and then patch them in with their story to make something that somehow it seems believable. And one of the most important components that they use is these travel restrictions. And they say, oh, because so-and-so, his social credit was too low, so he couldn't buy a ticket to whatever. Well, that does exist. There are travel restrictions in China. So if you if there's a court judgment against you, they don't usually lock you up for it. Actually, almost never. What they do is they try and use various measures to encourage you to pay. And this mostly happens with companies. So if the company defrauds somebody and they say, well, you're the responsible person in the company, you know, you should pay this money back. And if you don't, then we're going to make life tough on you. Then you can't buy high speed train tickets, for example, but you can, by the way, buy slow train tickets. You can't buy domestic plane tickets and so on. So this does exist, right? But then they come, the people that make these social media clips or whatever, even the Arte documentary, they say, oh, this is because so-and-so had low social credit or whatever. But that's just a complete fabrication. There's absolutely no evidence for that at all. They don't show anything of that. They didn't even show a screenshot of it. What the most you might get is people will show you a screenshot of Alibaba's Sesame credit system, which is a privately run company, right? And this, of course, gets to the other aspect of the anti, you know, the sort of the dystopian China propaganda. So they say, oh, well, you know, it's a company, must be run by the state. No, Alibaba is a huge privately owned company. You know, it's not the government. So no, they have their own little credit system where you can get things without having to pay for them in advance. And that's their system. It's nothing to do with the government. And certainly nothing to do with whether you walk over, you know, you walk across the street on a red light, you know. The amazing stuff is they show pictures in these documentaries of people walking across the street and say, oh, you know, so-and-so walked across the street on a red light and he was automatically fined for it from his WeChat account. I mean, the imagination that's required to come up with something like that is really all you do is sort of shake your head. That's absurd. How could that be? What if he doesn't have a WeChat account, you know? Just silly.
Scott, are you telling me that you're not going to be transported to the Xinjiang province and have your organs harvested?
I don't know. Life is long, you know. It could all happen at some point, but I think we have good hope of avoiding that up till now. But I can definitely still walk across the street on red, and nothing happened thus far.
Do you know that you're making China sound exceptionally boring? You're making it sound like just any other country.
All countries are different, right? And every country has its pluses and minuses, and we certainly have plenty of minuses in China. But I don't agree with you. I can see how the depression might have come, but it is different. I mean, particularly, I mean, you look at our silly zero speech policy. I don't think any other country has anything quite like that. I don't know. I don't know. I don't even think North Korea has a policy that's stupid. But, you know, the relative economic freedom that people in China enjoy is also pretty hard to find in the West, certainly. Very few mm-hmm. Chinese feel it, you know, do annual tax declarations, for example. People don't get taxed on, they don't have to report to the government when they make money on the stock market or lose money. The government doesn't really interfere in your financial life very much at all. These are things that are really unknown in the West, right? I mean, just these completely different worlds. And of course, the big difference is that China is also an extremely safe country where you can basically, in most areas, walk around, you know, 24 hours a day and without any fear of being robbed or assaulted or anything on the street. That's a big difference with a lot of countries.
Well, I mean, I live in South Africa and we got one of the highest crime rates in the world. We have approximately somewhere between 50 and 70 murders per day, and about the same in terms of rapes. And this isn't...
Well, see, you're also exceptional, right? In a different way.
Exactly right. We are running out of time, but I think I'm going to have to invite you back because there's a lot I want to ask you and chat to you about. But for now, the elephant in the room, the COVID response. China was just brutal and inhumane and just ridiculously severe.
Well, I kind of agree with that to an extent. I mean, it was a lot of things that were done were definitely inhumane. There's no question about it. And we were very critical at the time of a lot of those things that went on. I think that, you know, you really have to, it's difficult because there was no one at the time that could really say they did a great job of handling it and they followed all the laws and respected human rights. I don't know of any country that did that. And that's not an excuse for China at all because, you know, we didn't agree with a lot of what was done. I think that maybe the most helpful thing is to put it in context and compare it to what was done in other places. So one of the things they really did, which no other country did that I know of, some did, but like the lockdown we had in Shanghai for 2 months where really no one could leave their compounds was pretty rare in the world. Not many countries did anything quite like that. And for a lot of people, they say, well, you know, that's the red line, you know, locking people in their compounds or houses or whatever. It's not acceptable. Okay, I get that where you're coming from. But you know, one of the big differences that very people realize is that China was also the only major industrialized country that actually made it illegal to coerce people to take vaccines. It was the only one. And I give Mexico an honorable mention here because Mexico tried, AMLO, you know, the president tried to do it, but there were some provinces that didn't go along with that. China, you know, the Chinese central government made it very clear that it was illegal to coerce anybody. And that includes, you know, penalizing them, not allowing them entrance into places you could not ask for proof of vaccination to enter a building in China. That was illegal. And there was some coercion that actually went on the ground, and there were attempts made. But that was the official stance of the government. And they, for the most part, they did adhere to that, even though there were some people on the, you know, lower levels that didn't so follow along with that. And so, you know, you could say, well, China did commit some human rights violations there, but they also were the only major industrialized country that respected the basic human right to bodily integrity, which I would say is kind of the most basic human right of all. Now, I'm saying that in defense of China, but you do kind of have to see that in that context, and it kind of depends on what you think is most important. So the short answer is yes, human rights violations definitely, you know, particularly from the economic side of it, it just made no sense at all what they were doing. And I personally, I said, this is not sustainable. They're going to have to give up. And it turned out I was right. So eventually the economics did beat them in it. But in terms of the inhumanity of it all, well, all I can say is I hope we learned some lessons from it. And I think that there is a good chance that we did. A lot of people, I think, have a very clear idea now of what they don't want for society. And they one of the things they don't want is the government running everything, because we saw how that worked when the government tried that, and it was a complete disaster. So I think that's a really positive thing we got from it.
Well, come to Africa and you'll see that the government is so inept and so useless that running things is not the government's strong point, and you can pick any African country.
Well, I think that it's not just Africa. I really think it's everywhere. I mean, and you can say some governments a little bit better than the others, but the basic principle is still the same. And what China tried, or wouldn't try, what Shanghai tried, what the Beijing government tried to do in Shanghai when they forced their commissar on us, was to force us to essentially plan the economy for 2 months in a city of 25 million people, the government planning everything. What an insane idea. But they really did try it, and it was a complete disaster. I mean, the government is absolutely not capable of doing, of running that many people, of coordinating the economy and making those decisions. And that was a really great lesson to be learned by everybody, because I don't think anybody really knew before that. I mean, the government likes to imagine they can do all these things, but I'll admit they did some things. What they did with the whole PCR testing, and at the end of the day, they did kind of get it to work, right? I mean, yeah, you have to take your hat off to them. It did kind of work, and they did. You can't say it was a complete failure, but at what price, you know? And, you know, at the end of the day, the economy is not just PCR testing. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. You got to feed people, right? Provide medical care. And none of that worked at all in that period. So, yeah, that's my take.
Just quickly, before we come in for a landing, would you say that China's private economy or privatized economy private sector, shall I say, is larger than that of the U.S.'s private sector?
Definitely. But that's because that really depends. It's a question of interpretation. Our position is that ultimately, if you look at the control that mostly BlackRock and its associated funds have over the U.S. economy and over many economies in the West, those are more or less equivalent to state-run control, because it's centrally managed. Yeah. And a lot of people will disagree with that, but I think it's quite comparable, because they, at the end of the day, are a central planning agency. And in if you look at the numbers, they're, you know, up there way over the 50% mark in the West in terms of control of the economy. And in China, the state has 25%.
Okay. So, I'm gonna have to bring you back, because time is now running out. So let me just quickly find out, how can I follow you?
Well, if you want to take a look at our Substack is austrianchina.substack.com. So Austrian as in the country, Austrian with an N, China, all one word, .substack.com. And we don't publish a lot. We try and publish the stuff we think is really important, but we do usually try and produce something every week or two in English.
Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you, Jerome. It was an honor.
No, the honor was all mine, that I can tell you. The information that I'm getting from you is just next level, so thank you. And thank you to Alex for keeping the show going. It's been an absolute pleasure being with you this whole week. Thoroughly enjoyed all the conversations. I am absolutely going to be getting Scott back. Wow. I love learning. I really do. And I love busting myths. Hey, Alex, busting myths. Isn't that such a cool thing to do? Challenging narratives. That's what it's all about. All right. Send me an email, germwarfare@tntradio.live. I will see you on Monday. My name is Germ. Oh, sorry, Steve Hook. He's up next. Don't forget to stay tuned for that. Right. Let me try that again. My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.